All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the fuckasaurus rexes? Yeah. How are you? Mark Maron here. That was short and sweet, that opening. That was the way that was going to go. I'm in the garage, as usual. I'm sitting here in my chair. Got the garage door open. It's nice and sunny. It's airy here in LA. It's not too hot. It's pleasant. From what I understand, we're in the middle of a significant drought. It's not stopping me from taking a shower, though. Am I hurting the country by taking a shower? I don't know. It's weird when things like that are reported, that there's a serious drought, and I turn on my faucet, and water's still coming out of it, so it doesn't quite register with me. Is that selfish? Is that ridiculous? In my mind, if there's a drought, you turn on the faucet, and it's just sort of like drip, drip, or it just goes. Today on the show, Pat Healy is a great actor. Pat Healy and I sort of have a history. You might know Pat Healy from, he's done a lot of work, actually. He was around the table and here and there in the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. He was also in Rescue Dawn, which was that Werner Herzog movie. He's done a lot of TV work. You would recognize him. And his new movie, this crazy fucking movie he's in, Cheap Thrills, which I saw, it's available. You can get it on DVD. You can get it at iTunes. You can get it on Amazon Instant. It is a dark fucking movie that tricks you into thinking it's a comedy. And it very well may be a comedy, but boy, does it go far. It pushes the envelope, man. Bit disturbing, Cheap Thrills. But Healy and I, he was sort of in and around comedy for a while when I first moved to LA, and he was buddies with me and my ex-wife. And then, like, I had forgotten, but not quite forgotten, the fact that he lived at my house for a while. He was my ex-wife's roommate. We're going to get into that. But great guy, great talk, does a lot of great movies, a lot of independent movies. You see, that's the thing, man. I got to get back into it, man. I got to get back into thinking about movies, into watching movies. Because it's like, if I'm not in the right, like, I think my brain has gone fucking screwy. My expectations are peculiar sometimes. But there was a time where I used to just bend my brain, over Rome Open City, over The Bicycle Thief, over Kane. I used to just bend my brain over 400 Blows, over Jules and Jim, over, like, I was reading Cahiers du Cinéma. I was doing everything I could to understand too deeply about movies, about art, about anything. And you got to age a little bit before you realize it's like, it's all what you put onto it. It's not necessarily designed that way. It's not like the artist comes to it and goes like, these are all the levels this will be operating on. So it's whatever you bring to it. But man, I thought there were answers. I thought there was a way. I thought I was missing shit all the fucking time, which I am. But it's all context. And who decides that context? You or the guy whose book you're reading that you may or may not understand. I go through these fits of sort of like, I'm not engaging in the arts enough. I'm not paying enough attention to the important things. I'm not appreciating the poetry of life. Why? This is what it's supposed to be about. How come I talk myself out of doing everything? This is what life is. Go see a fancy movie. Go see a difficult movie. Go challenge yourself with someone else's work. Why do you just got to sit there and go like, I feel fat. I don't want to go outside. I'm tired. Maybe I'll take a nap or masturbate. That's not a quality of life. It sounds pretty good, though. It sounds pretty good. It's not a bad afternoon. But it's not something. It's not a lifelong pursuit. I went to see Michel Gondry's movie, Mood Indigo, and I knew nothing about it other than I saw a coming attraction. It looked interesting. Holy shit. There was almost too much stuff going on in each frame of that movie. There was all these sort of stop-motion animation elements. There was all this kind of strange set work. To me, it was a very French movie in that what you had was you had a protagonist, this fella. He marries a girl, and they're in love, very passionate, and then she becomes ill. And there's that, and they have a friend who's a sort of a sycophant of a famous philosopher who is a satirical Jean-Paul Sartre. Did I say that right? It felt like I said it right. It always feels weird when I say it because I don't know how to pronounce French. So there's all these different elements, and so that's a pretty standard, tragic setup. love, girl gets sick, life comes crashing down on us through disease, death, age, all this stuff. But the undercurrent of this film is that there's so much going on. All these weird animation elements. There's dancing. There's music. There's these weird departures into some, you know, minor trajectory about weapon making. I mean, it was just so rich visually. And I realized his elaboration through animation and through activity and through playing with time was just the ornaments that he hung on this fairly tragic and very French story. So, was it a good movie? I can't tell you. I don't know. I'm not holding anything back. I just don't know. Was it memorable? There was a couple of things that were memorable. Did it move me? Not that much emotionally because I was so distracted by all the fireworks, but it was essentially those fireworks that took so much time. I can't even imagine how much time that it took him to put that stuff together. It looked like there were scenes in that movie where, you know, a 5 minutes of film could have taken a month to shoot. I'm not sure how it all went, but it takes a hell of an artistic vision. And I have friends like this too. I know film directors to sort of put all of that time and energy into something that is going to be, you know, fundamentally confusing and maybe distracting. I guess what I'm saying is I have to get away from the certain in creativity, the compulsion towards immediate gratification. Like, why don't I go see a show at LACMA? Why don't I go see that that one that everyone told me to go see? Was his name Bill Kelly? Why didn't I go see that? I don't know, because I couldn't get out of my house because I was too busy on Twitter or too busy struggling to get out here on the mic or too busy wrestling with my cock or too busy distracting myself with other things. You know, why do I need this sort of like too busy, like, you know, standing in front of my refrigerator, you know, eating out of several different containers? That is not life. Life is me going to a French movie that I walk away from saying, like, that was spectacular and elaborate. I'm not sure I got it, but he definitely did something there. I filled my head up with it. I'm talking to you about it. My point is I got to see more movies and probably masturbate less and not eat my feelings. That's a long way to go. It's not like I'm masturbating more than once a day. Sometimes I'll go a few days without it. Why am I being this candid? I listened to Duke Ellington this morning. Which Mood Indigo is a Duke Ellington song, and Duke Ellington is sort of one of the dozen or so sub-themes of the film. Never really took in Ellington that much, and this morning I took it in, and it was a pretty good way to start the day. I was a little weepy, and I felt nostalgic for a time that I didn't exist in. It's always good to have that kind of nostalgia. The nostalgia for an era that you have no access to other than through that music. Let's time travel back to New York in the 20s and 30s and 40s, Harlem preferably, and perhaps I'll be black and wear a hat. How would that be? Some big pants, pleated, some fancy shoes. That's not going to happen for me. That's not in my history. I can't even go back there, but I can listen to the Duke and go, this shit is good. See that? I filled up my life this morning with some Duke Ellington. I went and saw Happy Christmas, the Joe Swanberg movie, Mr. Mumblecore, the inventor of that, I believe. I think he's done like 70 movies. I think but Anna Kendrick is in it. Lena Dunham is in it. Joe Swanberg is in it. And that amazing woman from New Zealand, I love her, whatever she's in, I love her, Melanie Lynskey. I believe that's her name, Melanie Lynskey. Anyways, so I'd seen one of the other Joe Swanberg movies, I didn't really lock in. I didn't really follow him. But this movie was the opposite of the Michel Gondry movie. This movie was sort of, it's very simple. It's very improvised. He actually, when I was in the movie theater, Swanberg was doing a Skype, you know, Q&A. And he seemed like a very great guy. But the movie, now I watched the movie, and it was very low key. And he had talked about it all being improvised. And Anna Kendrick is obviously great. Lane is great. But it's weird how we get these mainstream movie expectations. Like whenever there was tension, emotional tension, and there was a cut that like I would expect like, oh my God, something's really going to turn here. But it's all very organic. And he shot it actually on 16mm, which was great. It'd been a long time since I'd seen film. So I was happy and excited to be happy and excited about film. And maybe I can talk to Swanberg. If anyone knows him, tell him I want to talk to him. Right now, let's talk to Pat Healy. I feel like we've waited long enough. Am I right? Jesus Christ, I can't. Having a hard time separating you from that horrifying movie.
That's okay.
Horrifying in a good way.
It's so funny because people go see it in the theater and they have a blast, but people who watch at home tend to be really disturbed.
They have a blast.
Yeah.
What does that mean, they have a blast?
Like they're screaming, they're yelling, they're laughing.
They actually cheer
like it's a Rocky movie when I don't even want to say it because it'll spoil
the
movie.
Yeah, no spoilers. Who wins in that movie?
The audience.
Yeah. It's about a man who just wants to provide for his family.
Well, on the surface of it, yeah. I mean, I think it's like, it's much more complicated than that because it's a man who is dealing with ego and not being able to provide. You know, you could say he's trying to provide for his family monetarily and money's being offered.
No, I think there's a lot of depth to the character in terms of his struggles and how he ended up where he ended up. And
he certainly could take care of them monetarily at some point. And
there was an easier way to go probably.
Yeah, and it becomes much more about, you know, this male ego and competition. And also I think not that the movie's, you know, deeply political or trying to be, but about, you know, a lot of women are the breadwinners now and guys aren't comfortable with that.
Right.
I don't have a problem with that. I'd be happy to sit at home.
I would have no problem with that.
Yeah. So yeah, this character sort of goes through this metamorphosis over a night with an old friend and lots of old rumblings get stirred up. And
there was a big jump, you know, in your friend's attitude at some point. And I know it was, you know, perhaps drug driven, but it was jarring.
Right.
Where it just became like, you know, about the money.
Yeah.
And about the winning. And look, I feel haunted by the movie. And it's not a bad thing. I think the movie was compelling. It became like a thriller.
Yes.
Because of the way it's set up. It's one of those, you know, the setup is, you know, basically what would you do for money? But the way that the film is structured and the intensity and the violence and the drugs and the weirdness of Koechner's character. After a certain point, when you spend time in Los Angeles, you're like,
you've been there. Yeah. And we've all stayed at the party too long at one point or another.
Right. Yeah. For a while, it's weird because it doesn't read as a comedy after a certain point.
No, it's strange. I mean, I don't even necessarily agree with them marketing the film that way. I realize you have to market the film as something.
Yeah.
And they're doing a great job, Drafthouse Films, at marketing and making sure people see it and people are seeing it. But like, what do you market that movie as? I mean, it's not a horror film, even though people are, you know.
It's kind of, almost.
It has, maybe you're more better marketing as a horror film and having people surprised that they laugh at it. I mean, you know, people laugh at Reservoir Dogs and they laugh at Goodfellas a lot. You know, I don't go to see Raging Bull when it shows in the theater because I'm embarrassed because I laugh through that entire movie.
Oh, yeah,
it's really
the way
funny.
They talk, yeah.
But I think people would be offended if I was laughing through certain parts of that.
No, I get what you're saying, but it's structured like a comedy.
Absolutely. It's a very dark, I mean, it's not dissimilar from After Hours or
that's right, exactly.
The Hangover or something like that. It's just like, it's like what would really happen in The Hangover? You know, we've said this before,
but
you don't go home to your wife and everything's okay at the end.
Right, but there's not a lot of cuteness in the movie.
No, none.
it's ugly.
It's vile.
Right. Yeah. So with The Hangover, at least you got, you know, Bradley Cooper.
Yeah,
you got Galifianoodles over there.
No.
And you got,
it's nothing cute about me before or after what happens in the movie.
It's a compelling film, and it's called Cheap Thrills. I don't even think we...
Oh, excuse me. My God.
What'd you do?
Mark, you made this coffee so strong.
I did?
Sorry, everyone at home.
What just happened?
You know, just went down the wrong pipe.
Oh, okay.
Know?
I didn't mean to make it so strong.
I thought I
nailed it.
There's some weird mishaps going on with my
I had an explosive
esophagus.
Coughing of a mouthful of red and green smoothie that just blew it out all over my window above the sink. And then all over, like, if there was one thing that's never happened to me before where I'm just like, and I coughed with a mouthful of this smoothie, and it was... It was a real spectacle.
At least it was. You knew you had a smoothie. If you had just coughed red and green, you'd really
I'm not there yet.
You worry about that stuff enough as it is.
I do worry about it a little. Less than I used to. Now that I'm 50, it...
Are you really?
Yeah. How old are you?
42.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy.
When the fuck... I'm trying to think where I met you, because, like, all these things are falling into place now. You know, Pat and I... Who am I talking to? Like, there's a third person here. Pat and I have a history.
We do. But I remember exactly when I met you.
Right.
So I was friends with your ex-wife, Mishna.
Yeah.
And through, because I did comedy for a while. I still do occasionally sketch stuff, but yeah. A decade ago, I started doing comedy and around. And so
we were doing like those mics with her.
Yeah, we did the mics. We had our own show in Los Feliz in the basement of the Ramada Inn, which I think you may have been gracious enough to stop by once or twice.
Was that your show?
Mine and Josh Fadum and Danforth France. And
the Fadum show. That clusterfuck show?
Yeah, exactly.
I hated it.
I
was so mad at
you. You didn't like it because we did sketches in between.
But
and
you
then
weren't
the
there the night I did it.
I wasn't.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I usually kept their asses in line. And I met Mishna. And then... I had been basically homeless for like a year. I was sleeping on couches. I had a bad couple of years professionally and personally.
Right.
And then I had rented a room from a building manager over in Los Feliz, just the same building I live in now, actually. And then at the end of that year, I was going to be out of town working a lot.
Yeah.
And you had just taken the Air America job in New York.
Yeah.
And Mishna was going to be out there with you a lot. And so she was looking for someone to house and cat sit for you.
She didn't turn out she was out there a lot.
And she ended up being here a lot. But yeah. I took that gig.
And you were roommates.
Here. We were roommates. I was gone a lot. She was gone, you know, a lot. But we ended up being here together a lot and becoming friends. And
you lived in my house.
Yeah, but I met you after she had already agreed to let me be, you know, watch your house. I suppose you guys discussed it.
Yeah.
And it was outside the M Bar, some show or something. Yeah. I remember you had a hat and you were smoking a cigar. But I'd seen you, and I knew who you were, obviously, but I don't think I'd ever met you.
That was the first time we met after you were going to be my wife's roommate?
Yeah. And I don't think we ever spent any significant time together until after you were already back and done with that job and everything.
And it was such a short time before the whole thing fell apart.
Yeah, so that was 2005.
Yeah, the shit hit the fan 2006.
I mean, a lot happened to me in this house. I quit smoking in this house. I got a lot of my first sort of big jobs and big breaks
in my house.
Like that. Yeah, happening here. Like I had a birthday party here.
In my house?
Yeah.
Oh.
You were almost never here, but like when you came back, we would watch Sopranos together. It was the end of the Sopranos.
Yeah.
We were watching that together.
God, there's so much in my
2007, right?
I think, yeah, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
I'm sorry if I'm stirring up.
Oh no, no, I don't mind. But 2007, that must have been right before she left me, right?
Did you guys split up in 2007?
Yeah, I thought so.
Okay, I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean,
I know you said you haven't seen her in 7 years, and it's 2014, so that probably makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was. Well, yeah, I don't think you and I were here alone. It must have been.
No, never.
I always liked you.
Oh, sometimes we hung out alone because if she was out of town, like remember I came and saw you do a show at UCB one night.
Yeah.
And we had dinner around the corner at the deli with Jerry Stahl
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
God, you got a good
memory. We hung out. We saw some movies together.
I never had a problem with you.
No?
Only fleeting times did I think you and my wife were fucking, but I didn't.
No, that never happened.
Of course not.
I'm looking you right in the eye right now. That never happened.
I know it never
happened. I knew you thought maybe at one point it might have happened, but
I was a crazier man. But then, like, I remember after I ran into you, the only time we had trouble was when I ran into you after all this shit went down. You're like, you know, I can't talk about it.
That was long after. The first time we saw each other again.
After that?
Yeah.
It wasn't that long after, and I was probably trying to pump you for info.
It was at Sundance in 2012.
Oh, yeah, that was a little weird, yeah.
And I had never seen you before in 5 years.
But we mentioned that they're, like, what did I say to you?
Well, you were really nice initially, and it was great. We were catching up and everything. Yeah. I think maybe I saw you before that downtown somewhere at a show or something.
Well, that's what I remember is that, you know, you can't weigh in on anything. It's uncomfortable because you're still friends with
her. Yeah, I just didn't feel like... Right. Well, it was like we were having a really nice discussion and catching up, and it was really good to see you, and you were clearly in a much better place.
Okay.
And then it got dark, like, for a second.
It did?
Yeah, I got angry.
I dropped out.
I didn't fault you for it, but I just thought, like, I don't want to get into that, like, you know.
I tried to put you in the middle. And
you didn't really. You were expressing your feelings very strongly. And I didn't want to like either validate or negate those feelings. You know what I mean?
Tough position.
And that was years ago, though. And it's like, look, I have been married and divorced, but, you know, that's okay. I've been in a relationship where there was never any, you know, I think closure is a bullshit word. I don't think it exists, but like... Where there was never any, like, you know, we're fine with each other if we see each other, but there really wasn't ever that moment where you, like, discussed it. And it just sits like a rock, you know? Well, it's like you live and you go on with your life and you forget about it. You don't think
ache,
about it most of the time.
But, dulls. Yeah. The ache. Yeah, I mean, well, I'm happy that, you know, she's. You tell me she's doing good. She just had another kid. And
yes.
Look, I'm thrilled. You know, I do want her to, like, my sadness now about that is, like, a lot of the anger is gone. But, you know, you do start to realize, like, I haven't seen her in 7 years. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's strange.
And, like, if there was just a moment where, you know, I would like to laugh and have coffee.
Right.
Is that possible? I'm not asking you.
No.
But, I mean, I think it is possible.
Well, I'll tell you, like, my experience with this relationship.
How long were you with this woman?
Like, maybe a year and a half.
A year and a half and you got married.
No, I'm talking about a girlfriend. The marriage, we can get into that, but like the girlfriend that I have
now.
No, that I had that kind of had this like we can't get together and laugh about things.
Right.
Was at some point it would have been all right if I hadn't kept pushing after it was clearly over and acted like a psychopath and basically, you know, a stalker. And
I
and
did that. Emails. I stalked. I wrote a one-man show. I fucked her friends. Yeah, I don't know if it's
so it's
back
fine on. Now, but you can't, you can't ever like go.
What's the matter?
I know. Yeah. It's like, hey, because like if she were to decide, hey, you know what? It's water under the bridge, which basically she's doing, but.
But she's got two kids.
From my perspective with this girlfriend that I had this thing with, like, I don't blame her because I acted like a complete fucking wacko, like, regardless of what she did or what went down or both of us being responsible, like, at some point I acted like a complete maniac and I don't blame her for not wanting to sit down and have coffee with me and laugh.
Yeah, I get that. And I think the problem with what I had to learn from all this is that, you know, it all ended quite badly and I behaved quite badly during it and after it. But, you know, what's still there is that, you know, she was important in my life and I loved her. You know, that doesn't go away.
Right.
So, you know, it's not like any of that can be acted on. But, you know, those kind of things stick in your heart forever and they, you know, they fade and they ebb and flow. But, you know, there's some part of the heart that just wants to be forgiven.
Yeah, you want to be forgiven, and also you don't go in your mind like, we never really did love each other. You can't say that. You were married. You were together for a long time.
Yeah, like, I think that's true.
If you want to talk about my marriage, I was married for 3 months.
How did that happen? How long were you with her?
No, I hate having to say that, but this is the place to say it. So I met a girl... a woman, actually, around the same time I was doing comedy here, and then in 2004, and then she moved to New York.
Yeah.
And then when I was doing a movie in 2010 on the East Coast, she got back in touch with me, and we started dating.
Yeah.
Long distance. Shortly after we sort of decided that she was going to move out here to live with me, she was diagnosed with Lyme disease, which I don't know if you know anything about it, but it's...
East Coast thing.
Yeah, you know, ticks. You get bitten by a tick, but if you don't know that you got bit by the tick... If you know you got bit by the tick, you get antibiotics, boom, it's done. If you don't, you get this thing called chronic Lyme. And chronic Lyme is very controversial because it doesn't show up on tests. Like once you take antibiotics, it's gone, but it affects the nervous system and the brain and all this stuff.
A couple of people have had it.
People,
it's a nuisance.
Suffer from it. So, yeah. And then there's, you know, controversy over it because the AMA and all these organizations don't recognize it as being real. Mm-hmm. See, it's a psychological disorder, so there's... The jury's out on that.
As to whether it's a real disease?
Yeah.
No kidding.
As to whether those people still have Lyme or they're suffering some, you know, psychological disorder.
Because of it.
Because it doesn't show up on blood tests.
Weird. You know? All right, so she gets the Lyme.
And there's even a guy who discovered that, you know, something that may answer that question and then was suddenly struck with Alzheimer's and... Yeah, it's true. There's a documentary called Under the Skin that's all about this.
You can't get to the answer.
Yeah, exactly. So very quickly, in rapid succession, I had to move her out here. She had a dog. I had to rent a house, actually, out here in Eagle Rock and move out of my apartment and assume all these responsibilities of taking care of someone. I was also unemployed.
Were you married already?
No, but I...
You loved her.
I loved her. And I felt this obligation, you know, which I recognize now as you know, a lot of shame and guilt that was given to me as a Catholic, you know, kid. And even though my parents are great and love me very much, you know, you just grow up with that stuff. And then she didn't have health insurance, and I have health insurance through the Writers Guild and through SAG. And it actually came up with a doctor, a very irresponsible doctor of alternative medicine who, you know, presented that idea. And then it wasn't like I could not have the discussion.
She
with
said
her.
It in front of you?
Yeah.
Like he said maybe
she
should
said,
marry
well,
him.
Maybe you should get married. You know, so you don't have to be forever, but you'll have the coverage or whatever. And it's like
that's such an LA.
And then it really put pressure on me. And then I did it. And then it was right away that it was a mistake.
Ugh.
Like we didn't.
I've been through one.
Get
this.
Along. The it wasn't one. Like even the illness or anything. It was just we just didn't get along. And
yeah.
And so after 3 months, I left. And then it was a long period of time of separation
mm-hmm.
where I actually lived with our friend Brendan Small in his house.
Oh, really?
So Brendan and I, we did our thing then for like 5 months. And then I moved back into the building that I live in, that I lived in before by myself. And eventually
that's where you're
the
back?
Divorce went through. Yeah, and I've been there for...
What kind of divorce was it, though? Was it contentious or did you just get it done?
Yeah, it ended up being contentious.
Really?
After
a year and a fucking half.
I found out that... we were together for less than a year, the marriage. We were married for 3 months before we separated. I filed... I assumed it was going to be a default, in which case, you know, in California, if the other
after 3 months
doesn't respond,
right.
Then you can't get an annulment here unless you're cousins or,
right.
You know,
right.
The person turned out to be 14 or something. So, I thought it would be a default. I thought she wouldn't respond. And
right.
She responded, and it's unclear whether or not she didn't understand that she didn't need to respond or whatever. We weren't actually communicating great, and... It was really funny, you know, Joe Wagner, our friend, agreed to, he's a good friend of mine, he agreed to be the guy that served papers on her, but he didn't understand that it wasn't a surprise that she agreed to meet and get the papers served to her. I just couldn't personally serve them.
Right.
So Joe put on a disguise and hid behind a plant.
And scared
like
her.
Like a hat and like sunglasses and a fake mustache. And then she was like, are you Joe? He's sitting there crouched, sweating. But
because you told her that Joe was coming?
Yeah. She knew, like, but he thought, you know, he'd seen too many movies and TV shows. He thought he had to sneak up on her.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was like a year and a half of, like, she was also ill during that time and sort of off the grid for, like, 9 months. And then she finally came back and said, you know, sorry, you know, I was hurt and I was also not feeling well and all that. And we actually had a series of really nice civil meetings and talked about everything. And you know, I took care of her just because she had relocated from New York to LA and all that stuff and took care of it. But it was a long, drawn out thing.
God damn, man. You know, it's like, you know, some of us are just not destined for the simple life.
I don't know. I mean, I'm you know, the woman I'm dating now, we've only been dating for 6 months, so it's too early to say, but I don't know if I'd get married again. I know, you know, there was a point in time, too, that I definitely wanted kids, and then I definitely didn't. And now I have nieces and nephews that I love, and I love spending time with them, but I get to go home and go to sleep, you know?
It's yep. Like,
so I really don't know.
Your nieces and nephews are here? Your brother? I met your brother.
Yeah, my younger brother has two kids here.
He's an artiste, isn't he?
Yeah, sure.
I can't remember. What does he do?
Well, he works for a clothing designer now called Todd Land, but he's a musician. He's a painter. He's an artist.
I remember him. Were you guys working together on
He probably hung out here a few times.
Yeah, I remember meeting him. Yeah. Where are you guys from?
Suburbs of Chicago, Arlington Heights, Illinois.
Well, you know, it's weird because, like, you show up in movies, but you've been in a lot of stuff. And, like, I really didn't. I knew you as this comic guy who did movies occasionally. And then I remember I was very excited to see you in that great movie, you know, The Assassination of... what's the full title?
Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford.
Yeah, I love that fucking movie.
I'm in a lot of movies that people don't love when they come out, but like 5 years later, everyone loves.
But that was when I first realized that you have one of those bodies and one of those heads and one of the, that you just fit on camera perfectly.
Oh, thanks.
Do you feel that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was, I always wanted to do that and I don't know if I somehow you make a physiological change to make your body fit that or I just happen to be that type physically.
No,
or,
I think you are.
Yeah, I was born to do it. And, you know, I've been doing this professionally for 20 years now. And it's really kind of only now that people know my name or
put it
I'm
together.
Even allowed to like be, you know, a guest on your show, even though, you know, like, no disrespect, but like, you know, I don't know that I would have had that much to offer to, I mean, I certainly have a lot to talk about, but like in terms of people knowing the name and the face now a little bit more because of these smaller movies that I've done, you know.
Yeah, well, what was the other one, the crazy one that you were up at Sundance for?
Oh, Compliance. Yeah.
I didn't get to see that one.
So that was, you know, a very controversial movie, but as I think, you know, Cheap Thrills is too, but in a different way, Yeah, about it based on real events where a guy was calling fast food restaurants pretending to be a cop and got managers. In this case, it was a McDonald's, but in fact, fictionalized in the movie. But give their employees strip searches. In this particular case, ended in a rape, a sexual assault. So it's a very messed up movie that people found very compelling and either really upsetting or terrific.
Did you kick ass in it?
I'm told I did. You know, it's largely my voice on the phone for a lot of the movie because I play the guy who's the caller.
The raper?
Yeah. And then I'm kind of sitting there the whole time and I'm, you know, I've got a lot of, you know, kudos, you know, I got a lot of good reviews for that and everything, but I was sitting in a chair the whole time, all coiled up. And I'm like in Cheap Thrills, I'm like that for the first part of the movie. And then I just get to let it all out, which is very
short time.
Very cathartic, you know.
At the first part of the movie. Yeah, you really cut loose. But you got a natural way about you. I was watching, you know, having done two seasons of my show and not really being a trained actor in watching myself, there's something about, you know, the lack of self-consciousness around like the sort of taking the time to do things when you're not talking in a natural way seems to be the tricky thing.
Well, it's interesting because I would think for you, and maybe this is something that hasn't occurred to you, is like you're known as a very active listener on your show.
Yeah.
And that's really what it is.
Sure.
You know, we've seen like great comedians or musicians who have that natural ability who don't realize to just use those same tools.
No, I do that, but like I think that like even in real life, I'm a little stilted. I'm a little overdramatic. Like I use my hands a lot, and when I'm listening, like if I'm listening, I'm not necessarily moving.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas like, and maybe I'm being too judgmental on myself.
Well, you're also very cerebral, so it's like you can't be cerebral when you act. Like
You have to
do all the cerebral stuff at home, and then when you show up, you have to, you know, just be there to play.
I think I did all right. What I would usually do is just sort of like, just be in the moment.
I thought you were very good in Birbiglia's movie.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I just try to be in the moment. That's the best I can do.
Yeah, well, that's all it is, you know. It's like, it's a lot of homework. That's a lot of people don't realize. Not only because you can't think when you're doing it, but you don't want to sit around and waste everybody's time. I mean, there's guys that really don't give a shit that are holding lights all day long and boom mics and
stuff.
Sure,
yeah,
that, like,
you can't. You know, you gotta respect them.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's about you, it's your show, it's called Marin and all that stuff. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a job for a lot of people and I don't want to hold them up. But I mean, mostly like process and all that stuff is stuff that's done at home. And
well, with a show though, you know.
That's hard. I mean, I've done 30 guest stars on TV shows and you have no time to prepare.
Nothing.
You got pages and pages of script a day.
Yeah.
I mean, in a way, we're shooting these movies like with Cheap Thrills. We shot that in 14 days. So we were shooting like 10, 12 pages a day. But
that's
like,
crazy.
You know, I remember doing like NYPD Blue years ago and David Milch would hand me a 5-page monologue that morning. You know what I mean? And then he just go, oh, don't worry about it. You know, we got 3 cameras going. And, you know, if you go up on a line, just call line and we'll call it. And then they cut it together. But what they end up doing is sort of like cutting out all of the nuance, all the interesting stuff that
they
you do.
They just want coverage,
it's
man.
It's just your head saying the lines, you know,
they
with the other
actors.
They
just want coverage. They just want to make sure that they got something to cut with.
I guess that was great for me because I did, you know, I had like a good decade of doing that. And it was good training for being in front of a camera. But then when, you know, really only like in the last 10 years, less than 10 years, I mean, basically around the time I knew you, like started getting offered bigger roles in these smaller movies and really being able to feel good about what the work I'm doing. Like I can go back and look at those other movies and go, I had talent and, you know, I have presence or whatever. But in terms of really knowing what I'm doing and having confidence in myself.
Feeling proud of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, did you go, like, so you grew up in outside of Chicago.
Right.
And what, how many kids in your family? Just you and your
brother? I have 3 brothers.
3 brothers.
Yeah. Two older and 1 younger brother.
What did 2 older ones end up doing?
So my oldest brother was a musician for a long time and then he became he went to motorcycle mechanic school, basically. He was a master technician.
But he was in bands and stuff?
He was in bands, yeah. Like his band played a lot with Billy Corgan's band, the Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, yeah.
And this band, Material Issue.
I remember Material Issue.
Those bands were getting big at the same time.
Material Issue, he killed himself, right?
Yeah,
he was a Chicago guy?
Yeah, they would all play shows together. I would lift their gear and stuff like that.
Fucking that one, what was it, movie something soundtrack? The Material Issue
album?
Oh,
yeah, yeah. Motor City soundtrack
maybe,
or something like
that's
that?
That's a great record.
Yeah, yeah, it was great. And it was really surprising to everybody that happened.
Oh, man. Yeah, they were like a great pop band. It was a type of music that at that time was not that sellable.
No, but that first album did pretty well. I mean, it was like right at that boom of the alternative, you know, stuff happening again.
So you used to lug gear for Billy Corgan and
stuff? Yeah. Those guys were always really nice to me. I was in college at the time.
How was seeing him play before he was big?
We always thought they were great. I mean, really? They were known at the time as being the, you know, the great band in Chicago too.
I didn't realize they were from Chicago.
Yeah, he had hair. And,
yeah. You know. So your brother was just, and his band was hard rock too?
Yeah, they were like sort of that same sort of like psychedelic sort of hard rock, you know.
And what, he just let it go?
Yeah, it just sort of just wasn't happening. And he went to motorcycle mechanic school and he became very successful at that. He worked for BMW San Francisco for many years until that got bought and sold, and now he's mostly a stay-at-home dad. His wife works for, you know, Wells Fargo. She does really
they
well.
They live around, they live in the Bay Area?
Up in Oakland, yeah. And they have a daughter.
So everyone's close by. And what about the other brother?
And my brother Jim is, you know, a huge cinephile like me. We grew up with loving movies. So he, you know, basically when I was 7 and he was 9, I wanted to make movies and he wanted to watch them and show them, and that's what he does. He worked for many years at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, which is like one of the largest motion picture.
I performed at that theater.
Oh, did you at the Dryden?
Yeah.
Okay, in Rochester. Oh, yeah. So he programmed the movie theater there, and he was assistant curator of the motion picture collection. So basically, if you want the original camera negative of Gone with the Wind or Wizard of Oz, that to make a new DVD or whatever, that's where it is. And
oh, they've got that stuff.
Yeah, Scorsese keeps the majority of his print collection there. It's an amazing, you know, museum as well.
He's still up there?
No, he left there a few years ago, and he moved to Madison, Wisconsin, and he runs the University of Wisconsin Cinematheque and the Wisconsin Film Festival.
Does he teach?
No.
He just runs it.
I mean, occasionally he does. Yeah, he runs the Cinematheque and he programs the Film Festival.
It's a good town, Madison.
Yeah, well, he's got a kid now, too, a 5-year-old daughter, and it's... I mean, Rochester was becoming such a shithole. Sorry, Rochester, but like...
It's a little rough up there.
Well, it was like all these big businesses, Kodak, Xerox, basically every business that went out of business.
Because of technology.
Yeah, my mother was violently mugged walking to church, you know,
in Rochester.
Day. Yeah, I mean, like, it was getting bad.
Why was she there?
She was just visiting.
Oh,
you know?
My God. That's horrendous.
You know, and
then Niagara
like
Falls is right up from there.
And it's just grim, you know?
Oh, it's grim,
so, like,
dude.
They moved to Madison, which is a great town. And,
great
and
town.
It's a great town to raise a kid in. And then my younger brother.
He's got kids, too, now?
Yeah, he's got 2, yeah.
Jesus.
I have a nephew who's 4, and my niece was born in July, so she'll be, what is that, 9 months old?
Yeah. Did you go to college?
Yeah, well, I did, you know, I got into acting, even though it's just movies is really what I want to be involved in.
Because that's what you're always talking about when I remember, you're a big film head.
Yeah, so I, you know, it was what I knew how to do as a kid.
What do you mean as a kid? You were a director?
I was an actor, you know. I was a little ham. I performed, you know. I was in plays, you know. I played the Wolfman in some, like, you know, school district play that was about all the monsters.
Yeah.
I knew all the other kids' lines.
You loved it,
I was
though.
That little asshole.
You loved it. It was your thing.
Yeah. And then, but, you know, always, you know, watching movies, catching up on, you know, these are days before home video. So it's like you watch something, Planet of the Apes, edited for television, you know, where it's like a 2.5-hour movie that's edited to fit with commercials in 2 hours. You know?
Still there.
But it's still amazing.
Apes are great.
So, you know, and then I did it all through high school, acting, and then went to college at Illinois State University down in Normal, Illinois.
Yeah.
And Normal, as it turned out, I went there because I wanted to go to DePaul University in Chicago, which is, I thought in my mind, a little more prestigious.
Yeah.
But A, my parents were going to make me live at home and commute, which I didn't want to do. I wanted that college experience. And B...
For financial reasons?
Yeah.
What'd your old man do?
He was in corporate. He was actually worked for Arthur Anderson. He retired like within a year before everything went down the toilet there.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Did he see that?
Good
coming?
And bad. I mean, you know, he got screwed a lot on his pension.
Oh,
and
he
stuff
did?
Like that. So,
oh, because they lost it all.
Yeah.
God damn it.
And my mom was in corporate too, like mostly human resources. She worked for... They both kind of worked around the phone company. Like, my dad started at, like, Illinois Bell, like, when the Bell system was still in place.
Corporate people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But people really into the arts and really movies and music. And my dad's a huge, like, you know, vinyl collection like you do.
Does
and,
he?
Not so much anymore, but he did, you know, jazz and mostly jazz and classical and R&B music, old rock music and stuff like that.
So you grew up with that?
All that stuff.
It's good.
And
good
then,
to have that.
You know, Steppenwolf Theater started at Illinois State University, and they offered an internship for... graduating seniors every year.
Stephen Wolf did.
Yeah. So that's like Malkovich, Gary yeah. Sinise, Terry Kinney, Jeff Perry, Laurie Metcalf, Joan
Allen.
And that
guy, the guy who's the big play right now, Letts. And
Tracy Letts is now, who was one of my first people I met on my first day of work there.
You're in the drama department at Illinois State,
mm-hmm.
and you apply for this internship at Steppenwolf.
Yeah, you audition for it.
You audition for it.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal. Steppenwolf yeah. is fucking balls to the
Huge.
Wall. That's
yeah,
real.
Like one of the most
What'd you do
well-known.
For your audition?
I'm trying to even remember. I think they gave us like different scenes, like from You Can't Take It With You.
Uh-huh.
And then I did
from
a mock.
You Can't Take It With
yeah,
You?
Yeah, or something like that, you know. But the person that always got it would like be like the guy that did something weird in the scene. So, you know, You Can't Take It With You is like a big group, you know, play.
It's a Kaufman and Hart thing
yeah,
or something,
exactly.
right?
Yeah. It's like a big ensemble thing. And I remember it was the year before or 2 years before one of the guys who was in the scene, you know, like everybody who's auditioning for it, all the seniors are auditioning yeah. together, just started taking his clothes off during the scene. And that was the guy that got it. So
yeah.
I'm sure I did something weird, but I don't remember what it was.
So now, when did the internship start? Was it coinciding with your last year, or did you actually,
no,
after
it was
college?
It began in the fall after I graduated.
Holy shit, that must have been fucking exciting.
And it was amazing. I mean, my first time there was Steve Martin had written his first play, so he was there, and he's one of my childhood heroes. I mean,
yeah.
comedy was a huge, you know, thing for me as a kid, and I remember my dad bringing home that Let's Get Small album, and then I was into all of his movies and all that stuff, so he was there hanging around doing his play, which Tracy Letts, as you mentioned, was an actor in, and, you know, I met a lot of my good friends now. You know, within that year, I had gotten cast in shows there.
Well, what was your job as an intern? How does it start? What do you do?
I was allowed to audition for every play, but I was, you know, and I got a couple two understudy gigs while I was there, and I even went on stage for one show. But I did stage crew. I was a production assistant. I would aid the playwright.
And what were
director.
Some of the plays that were doing it? Who were some of the actors?
Well, we did Libra, which was the adaptation of the Don DeLillo book mm-hmm. about Oswald, which yeah. was Malkovich adapted and directed it.
So he was there.
He was there. And
Alexis
was
like?
Arquette was the star of that.
Oh, really?
And Michael Shannon was his understudy.
That's how Michael
I became
Shannon.
Friends with Mike. Yeah.
Oh, you're friends with Shannon?
Yeah, we're really good friends.
He kind of popped a few years ago,
now.
Huh?
Yeah. Academy Award nominee.
So he was
and Malkovich was amazing. I mean, if you were an actor in Chicago, like I grew up, like, you know, I discovered Mickey Rourke at a young age, and then that led me to he was my gateway drug to Brando and De Niro and all those people. And then
yeah.
if you lived in Chicago, it was like Steppenwolf, like those guys were legendary for getting on stage and like throwing shit at the audience's head, and
tearing
stuff.
It up. I think they did a very famous. I think Sinise and Malkovich's True West
yeah.
started there.
And Malkovich tells this story of beating up a toaster with a golf club, and the head of the golf club broke off and flew off and hit an old woman in the head, and he stopped the play and he walked out and he said, "Are you all right?" And she said, "Yes." And he went back on stage and just kept doing it. It was that kind of thing.
I saw Malkovich do Burn This in Manhattan.
Yeah, that's incredible.
It was
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, kind of legendary. And I actually got cast in a small role in a play that he was in
uh-huh.
called The Libertine, which he ended up making as a movie a few years ago with Johnny Depp.
Uh-huh.
And we would just stand there and watch him. I mean, he would do something different every night and just like, you know, wild. But I was talking to Mike Shannon, like we all thought that Malkovich was really being violent and doing all those things. It was very, you know, choreographed to look that way and very powerful. But like when I would do a play with Shannon, we would have fight choreography and he would make me act. He would just, you know, ignore the fight choreography and make me beat him up. And I remember I was just repeatedly hitting him over the head with a metal garbage can, just trying to get him to go limp, you know?
Yeah.
Like we were those kinds of like, you know, we wanted to be these, you know, ferocious alpha male, you know, brooding dark actors. And the first play that I got cast in at Steppenwolf was A Clockwork Orange. It was a stage adaptation of Clockwork Orange. No, I was, you know,
one of the guys,
you know, eight different parts, you know, in the thing. But I met a lot of my good friends who are pretty well known now. Nick Offerman was in that production. Guy named Paul Adelstein, who was on the show Private Practice for a long time and worked with the Coen brothers in the movie Intolerable Cruelty, and many, many people. Like that show was sort of famous for the guy who played Alex, the DeLarge, had an enormous penis and whipped it out every night and masturbated.
What happened
in front
to that
of the
guy?
Crowd? Well, I don't know.
What's his name?
Ken Freeman.
Yeah.
And every night you would stand backstage and just hear from an, you know, 500 people way back in the balcony.
It's that big of a space, Steppenwolf? 500?
Yeah, it was a, you know, a small place that started in a church basement. And by the time I got there in the 90s, it was a big operation.
Well, it's just interesting because this is the first time I've talked to somebody. You know, usually when I talk to comedians or comic actors about Chicago, it's all Second City.
Which is wild. I talked to like Matt Dwyer about this. Like, we're blocks away. I mean, we drank at the same bar, but rarely did we. We never interacted with that world. I never did comedy until I came to L.A.
But it's interesting to me that it's equally as important in producing talent.
Yeah.
Both as directors, writers, actors. I mean, a lot of people came out of there. So as a young man, you're watching this stuff and you want to be an actor and you've got certain chops. You did basic stuff in college. Did you have a teacher in college that blew your mind and made you realize, you know, how? Because like I talk to actors and it's very difficult to talk about craft or to talk about training because, you know, either you have the gift or you don't.
Right.
And that gift is either sort of honed with guidance by somebody that means somebody. There doesn't seem to be like I think David Mamet tried to write a textbook about acting.
Yeah.
But he had a whole school, the Atlantic School. Yeah. And his basic premise.
And they still have a theater company and that's in a New great York. Theater. But it's right. A very specific school of acting if you see his films.
Well,
I mean,
right.
You know.
Well, his idea is like, you know, any idiot can act.
Right.
And you just have to apply these things. And that's clearly not true.
Well, everyone in his movies talks like David Mamet. So it's like,
it's very stilted.
It's good at that. And
right.
It's good. I like it, but it's, you know, it's
okay.
It's
servicing his voice. And I think there's an arrogance to making that presumption.
No, our school was very much based in, you know, Stanislavski. And,
right.
And, you know, a lot of passion and you
right.
know, fire, probably maybe, you know, too much. I mean, a lot of great teachers, a guy named Patrick O'Gara, who's since retired. And I just found out, like, one of my first teachers, Sandy Zielinski, she retired. We had this legendary teacher, Gene Scharfenberg, who taught Malkovich and all
yeah.
these people, who, when I was there, was this lady who was 70 with big flowing white hair and giant glasses, wore a cape and walked around with a cane, you know, and called everybody love and would get up in the middle of a play if she didn't like it and say, "I'm bored. Is anyone else bored?" and walk out, you know. And she taught this class called Animals, which was, you know, if you were really special, you got selected as a senior to be in that class. You picked an animal for the semester, and then you would be that animal, and then the animal over the, you would do a kill,
yeah,
and then you would get killed at the end of it.
Uh-huh.
And then that character, the animal would become a human character as the class progressed over. So it was like, you know, really like a, you know, raw acting, you know, sort of.
That's interesting.
Class. And then she retired right after that, so I was in the last class.
So when you say like Stanislavski and you know that sort of old style method, that so they were running Stanislavski through the Steppenwolf.
Well, Stanislavski sort of by way of the group theater, which is
New York,
you know,
Lee Strasberg.
Kazan, Strasberg, more Stella Adler than Strasberg.
Yeah.
I think like Strasberg is really much like the. More leaning towards the Daniel Day-Lewis, like, you know, you must become the character. And,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know if Daniel Day-Lewis is a good example. I mean, Strasberg was big on using your own feelings, you know, as substitutions for things, you know. So you would, if you had to cry, you'd think about your father dying or things
and
like
that.
It,
and what's the other side?
I mean, Stella Adler's, you know, whole thing is sort of like it's all in the text. And if you really analyze that text and you read it over and over again, if it's good, it's there. And then it's really just about using your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't play an emotion. You can't go like, oh, I'm going to be sad here. It's like you have to pick an action. You know, you have to look at the scene objectively and go like, okay, I'm going to do this. And then if I do this right, and this is in the text, and I've analyzed this right, you know, and you'll hear De Niro talk about this because he studied with her and everything. It'll come, and Brando studied with her too, you know, it'll come. And it does, you know, and really this movie is really the first time I've been able to apply all of that.
Well, you acted the fuck out of it.
Yeah, I mean, the Animals class, like, this is the first time it's ever come back in my mind of, like, really being, you know, I become an animal, you
isn't
know.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
That's
and now I feel like I, you know, there's a scene in the movie after I mutilate myself where I, you know, have this big explosion and people
insane.
Sort of talk about it. And it was insane and it was, but I don't know that I'm going to be able to do that on that day. I trust that I do and I know that other people trust I do,
that felt
but I've
like
never done it.
It felt like it came from child's place.
It's everything. It's my entire life.
But it's that moment too.
It's 40 years of everything.
Well, right. Well, you know that moment though where a kid falls down and doesn't know whether he's going to react or not.
Right, at first, yeah.
Yeah.
There's this moment of silence,
yeah,
and then
like, yeah!
And I said, like, I know I'm going to have to pull up everything here because I imagine in my mind that emotionally and physically that's the worst pain anybody could ever feel. And so we pull it up and we do it, and this comes out of me. What's really interesting is, like, the layers of it. I was just talking to my shrink about this yesterday.
Yeah.
Is I'm in pain, I'm screaming, I'm in terror. Then there's sadness, there's tears. And then somebody wrote this about this in a review, and then I start laughing. It's like one's underneath the other. There's like all this muck inside you, right? And then it's like all that shit. You know, the anger is covering up sadness, which often is covering up joy. That's like stuff way down there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the first time in my life I really fully, truly experienced it and knew that I could do this and knew what this was all about. You know, I could talk about it all day and I've been good in other things, but this was the first time. And
where it all came together.
Yeah, it was like, boom, oh, wow, magic.
Because the arc from that moment on, once you go through that, and you know, and then
you wouldn't buy the rest of the movie if it doesn't work. And for me, I don't want to, like, you know,
yeah, but I think that the emotions of the rest of it were good because it was also a baptism in some sort of weird, you know, like when you talk about all those feelings and, you know, pain and joy and sadness, but you also made this horrendous decision.
Right, right. You it's know, everything.
To you know, for money.
Yes.
It's complicated psychology.
Maybe.
Of it.
And is it for the money? You
yeah.
know?
Oh, right.
You know, or is it's it for like, the punishment? You know, it's like, it's all these things. And I describe it as like this tap opened up in me that I didn't even know was closed. But I like that magical key that you always look for in therapy or whatever, like that's going to be the answer to all of your things.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
you know, like
the missing piece.
Was I molested? Am I gay? Whatever might be, you know? And it was just, I still don't know exactly what it is, but it was just there. And then they lost the tape. They erased it.
Stop it.
I'm not kidding.
Stop it.
I'm not kidding. Like everybody was perfect, like the camera, and we didn't have a lot of time or a lot of takes on this movie.
So that was
like
the second take?
I did it like 2 days later, like three more times. And what was remarkable is that I was able to
go there.
Yeah, and now I know that I can, you know. I even had written a blog about how important it was to me, you know, the day that we did it, because I realized that it wasn't about what you're gonna see or like what it was, the experience of doing it to me. And sometimes that's all you're gonna get. Like maybe no one will ever see it, and maybe no one will ever like it, but you have that, you know?
Right, but you'd put all this work in, all this craft in place, and this particular script, out of all the scripts, demanded that you reach this point.
Yeah, especially since if you didn't do it, this script could easily just be a sort of
But I'm sure you surprised the director. I'm sure that, like, because if you think about it, because now that we're talking about it, in that, you know, clearly the writer said this was a dark comedy.
Right.
But, you know, at some point, and I think now after talking to you, by virtue of your performance in and of itself, it transcended that. Because if you think that, because that scene, the way it's written on paper could really be dark slapstick.
Sure.
That you guys played it so straight, which is the way to go. But I don't think the screenwriter could have realized the depth of horror that could be reached to that. Because if you think about the, like, this and that, and then that reaction,
right,
if it, with a slight tweak, it would have played a slapstick.
And you know, I would say that you're right, and I want to give credit to the director, whose name is Evan Katz, because when he cast me, I wasn't anybody's choice.
Right.
He saw this movie, Great World of Sound, that I did, you know, that was actually the movie I went to film when I was living here, in which I play a very real, grounded character.
Yeah.
And I understood from him liking that movie and wanting me that that's what he wanted. That he had this opportunity to direct the script. He's a writer himself, but he didn't write the script.
Yeah.
That he did, that there was some version of this that even some people involved with the movie might have thought was fun.
Right.
And he wanted that kind of movie. And everyone else agreed. Even Koechner did not want to be shtick, you know what I mean? Like, you know, there are the things that are familiar about David that we love that invite us in to enjoy the movie, and then he turns the screws on you, you know?
But he didn't do any of what he's capable of, because that guy can go way out over the top.
Right, but I mean, you know,
he's played it close to the vest and
deep,
and menacing.
He sits there at one point and stares at Ethan for about 10 seconds, I swear, just staring into him. There's no dialogue, and you just don't know what he's going to do, and he's terrified.
Right, and his reactions, like, that seemed like real.
Yeah.
But it all seemed real, but like, you know, it gets to a point where you're like, how is that all going to...
I mean, you don't even know if it's going to work, because it's like, at some point, you have 14 days to shoot, which is like 4 days shorter than the shortest movie I've ever worked on. You got no money, you're in one location, it's 105 degrees outside.
Yeah.
Sometimes we lost power for a whole half a day.
Oh, my
God. You really don't have any other choice but to, like, set up two cameras, do it handheld, and really do it, which sort of harkens back to the days of theater and, you know, thinking about... I mean, I haven't done a play since I left Chicago in 1998.
Do you crave doing that, though? I mean,
I like to think about it, but what I can't stand is the same reason why I'm not a stand-up. Not that I would claim to be a great stand-up or anything, but the amount of time it takes
character
to
bits,
devote
though,
to it, I do, but I can't do the same thing over and over again.
Mm-hmm. No, I get it.
It drives me insane. And I worship you and Patton and all those guys now, like, you know, that can like do that. I've seen, you know, you or Patton do the same bit, but like just phrase it slightly differently and make it new
things
for them and just like be funny and fresh every time. But I, for myself, could never do that. So if that's what bothers me about theater a lot is I can't.
But don't you like the rush of it?
Well, I like the stage.
But
I mean, that's what comedy, like doing sketch comedy or even the little stand-up that I did sort of gave me that without.
Yeah.
I would do it again in the right circumstances, absolutely. And, you know, this is even sort of like a stage play in a way because it's mostly one location. But, like, I like interacting with the audience. Yeah, I just don't like the repetition of it.
So tell me, did you get? I want to believe that you got the Herzog movie while you were at my house.
I did.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, you know what happened was I
Rescue Dawn.
Yeah, I went down to Charlotte to shoot Great World of Sound. I came back for a weekend. I forget what for, to do something or other. I knew I had to come back for something, and they set the audition up for me, and I went to it, and I stayed here.
Uh huh.
And my manager, I remember, sent me a thing, said, you have this audition for this action movie, Rescue Dawn. And I was and I looked at it, and it was like Werner Herzog, you know. And I had this film studies class in high school, which was like, they only taught it like 1 or 2 years. And one of the movies we watched was Strozek, you know, which is, I was 16. That blew my mind.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, wow. And he was there, you know, I auditioned for him. And
so you auditioned for Herzog. What's that like?
Well, he was there with his son, who was a teenager at the time.
Yeah.
And his son videotaped everything, and he laughs a lot. He really enjoys watching you, which is good. You want to be enjoyed, like, as an actor. You go in a lot of rooms with people with their arms folded. And I think a lot about that story that you tell about Lorne Michaels when you went in, you know. Sorry to bring that up, but
it's all right.
I think about that a lot because
there are college students taking a shot right now.
the
Lorne Michaels game.
It's so vivid in my mind to be sitting across the desk from someone or sitting in a chair across from someone, having them film you with complete indifference, and then if you're like you or me, your mind is filled with like how horrible you are,
just
and all,
making up the
all
worst
the awful things that you've done, you know. And you get somebody like Herzog who you think has earned the right to be that way and isn't, is really like joyful, and you know,
he does amazing things and he does exactly what he wants to do
and you know, he's also like not this crazy maniac, like he's crazy like a joyful kid is crazy, you know. Like we did the scene in the end of the movie where we bring Christian Bale back, and the entire naval fleet is you know waiting for him inside the aircraft carrier. So they found like every white guy in Thailand that they could, and then they CGI'd, like, you know, they doubled it. Uh-huh. So there's like 300 guys there, and it's like, it had to have been 120 degrees outside, and we were inside a closed helicopter inside the aircraft carrier we come out of. So we were just soaked, sweat through. But we shot that day, and then it was crazy. And like Herzog, you know, is an older guy, like, he'd get up and run down the gangplank up and down all day long, like to like look at the monitor or whatever. Then at the end of the day, he got on the stage and he said, I want to thank everybody for coming. This is a very important story. It's my friend's story I'm telling. This is our leading man, Christian Bale. He was Batman. And thank you. And then he runs off. He drops the megaphone. He runs off. He runs down the gangplank.
Yeah.
And I'm not kidding. Every single guy that was there, 300 guys, he shook every one of their hands. And if one of them stopped and wanted to talk to him, he talked to them.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't leave until the last one was gone.
That was the last day of shooting?
And that was the first day of shooting.
How was Christian Bale?
Great.
Yeah.
I really felt upset a couple of years ago when that tape was released of him ranting because we've all had those days. And I've seen worse things
on sets. I had one yesterday in my living room.
He's a sweet guy and he's not this maniac. And I'm sure if I was doing Terminator 8 and, you know, some guy was fucking with the light above my head and I was trying to like commit to what I'm doing, like I'd be pissed too. But, you know, I'm sure he feels, you know, regretful of, you know, for doing it, but like really sweet guy, you know, and not one of these weird method guys that stays in character. Like he keeps his accent because otherwise it would get confusing. But I really, really had a great time working on it. And I got to tell Herzog, you know, when I was 16 years old, I saw this movie, Strozek, and it changed my life. And it's just such a pleasure to work with you. And he smiled and hugged me. I mean, how many people can say that? Especially if you're a movie nut. You know, if you're this kid that grew up just worshiping these people. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, and you've worked with some other, like, you know, Sam Rockwell I like a lot.
Oh, Sam is the best.
He's a trip, man.
I think Sam and, you know, Richard Jenkins and my friend Phil Hoffman, who's no longer with us, unfortunately, were really the best people that are acting right now, you know, like, consistently.
You know? How well do you know Philip?
Pretty well. I hadn't seen him in quite a few years. I'm really close with his mother and his brother.
Really?
Yeah. Well, because they're from Rochester, and I knew his brother, actually, before I knew Phil. And then
his brother's out here, right?
Yeah, Gordy, yeah.
Yeah.
And I knew Phil from, I met Phil doing Magnolia many years ago.
You were the pharmacist?
Yeah, exactly. And I was two pharmacists in that movie. I'm in the beginning of the movie and like a...
With Julianne Moore, right?
Yeah, with Julianne Moore. And at the beginning of the movie, I'm a pharmacist in Old England who gets killed in Greenberry Hill, London, who gets killed by three guys named Greenberry and Hill. It's one of those weird coincidental stories.
So Phil Hoffman, that was such a tragedy.
Yeah.
But, you know, he was wrestling with that fucking thing. Huh?
Yeah, it's horrible. And, you know, I don't... I think it came on sort of rather quickly after a long time of you know, I don't want to speak too much about it because it was very moving to me that I'd certainly been in touch with the family and left messages, but I didn't want to be intrusive or anything. And, mm-hmm. and then Gordy showed up to see Cheap Thrills here, and I would have never, I mean, I didn't even send out invites to people, but I would have never thought to, you know, invite him during this time. And he was really knocked out by it, and then he just told me this thing where I reminded him of Phil and how much I committed to it and everything, which is really like amazingly flattering but incredibly heartbreaking. And then Phil's mom, Marilyn, who as somebody I love very much,
yeah.
she was a family court judge up in Rochester.
Uh-huh.
She actually officiated the wedding of my brother Jim and his wife Katie, and you know, we're close. And she came, you know, the other night and was again not knocked out and wrote me something really nice, you know. And it's like, what can you say? Like, that guy, you know, I think was the greatest actor of my generation. And I mean, there's no question. And to have even been a part of someone like that's life, or, yeah, you know, any of these directors that we're talking about, to be a part of their body of work, you know, I still like struggle to get roles and make a living and all this stuff. But like, to me, on a level of personal importance, it's like, you know, it's right up there with my dad telling me he's proud of me. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Those people are really special people, and they're great people. And you know, we hear a lot about, like, you know, what a great actor Philip was and all that stuff. But you know, he also is a guy who's had children. You know, and it's difficult for me to even fathom, much less, you know, think about how his mother or his brother, you know, or sister is dealing with it. So, but they're really amazing people who showed up to see my dumb little movie, you know,
yeah,
and stick around to, you know, tell me that, you know, how much they enjoyed it and to say those nice things, you know.
That's great.
And so
it's very sweet.
I haven't really talked about this publicly, but, you know, cause I feel like it's like violating their privacy in some way, but like, you know, it feels okay to say, you know, like, I don't want to,
yeah,
it's not about me getting compliments. It's like, you know,
it's about,
like,
about friends.
Yeah.
And it's about, you know, being part of a family, and a family that obviously is supportive of the arts. And the
I mean, in a way, like, I think that family and their mom, like, is very similar to our family and the mm-hmm. way their parents raised us. That was a very important thing, you know? And so, the level of commitment that Phil brought to his work is something that I aspire to at least try to take it that seriously. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
and you
no matter what it is, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, it's certainly in this new film, I mean, you know, you put it all out there. It's weird that the opportunity comes in a film that is sort of specific,
yeah,
and bizarre.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that the best is yet to come, because, as you said, you know, for yourself and, you know, out of respect for, you know, for the work you put in, you know, you feel that, you know, you've sort of arrived in your own body as an artist.
Yeah.
And then,
like, this wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago.
Yeah,
no
way. So, like, when you talk about that, when you talk about people who've influenced you or people that have said things to you, you know, having, you know, either worked with the people or like seeing John Malkovich, were there moments that kind of, you know, kept you going, or were there things that you noticed in the work of others that you thought, you know, other than an ethic or a work ethic or just a commitment thing, like, where you're like, oh, that's how you do that.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, like, at a really early age, you know, longer. You know, when you hear people talk about seeing movies as kids, it's often like 10, 11, 12, 13. I'm talking about 5, 6 years old and seeing stuff, and 7, probably like Woody Allen and Mel Brooks and then Steve Martin and, you know, the comedians really at first.
Sure.
And then, you know, as a kid, just gobbling up everything. And then like, oh, when I was 12, my mom took me to see this movie, The Pope of Greenwich Village,
that
New York was in. And I, like I said, I hadn't really like seen a lot of De Niro or Brando, if at all, you know, and I was like, oh, wow. Like that guy was so cool. And that's what I want to be. And that was sort of like a direction where I was just sort of like, okay, I wanted to be that guy. I started doing my hair like that, you know,
like Mickey.
Yeah. When I had it, you know, the big pompadour, it was cool. I smoked for many years. I mean, all that stuff was probably because of that.
Yeah.
Know? It's funny. I just watched it again recently and it's so great, but I see all these things that I do that
really?
You know, just sort of became, you know, part of me. Yeah.
Like what?
I don't know, just certain little mannerisms or ways of speech and stuff like that, you know,
really?
Because he was like, he plays like a half Italian, half Irish guy in that. So it's like, I could like, you know, sort of conceivably, you know, resemble him in some way.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to be the guy who beats the shit out of the refrigerator and dents it in, you know?
Yeah.
And then that led to like, this is so going back so far. We got a VCR when I was, you know, right before I started high school. That was the first time. And that was discovering the Scorsese De Niro movies. That was like really
Oh my God. Yeah.
Knock me out. And then so it was just sort of this steady, like gobbling up all that stuff, discovering Kubrick and, you know, seeing the Godfather movies and all that stuff. And then
Al Pacino in the fucking Godfather 2.
Hey, that movie, holy moly.
That's the fucking movie, dude.
I mean, that movie's like the better movie.
Absolutely.
It's almost not even controversial to say that anymore. You know what I mean?
I think it's
they're both magnificent, but I mean, holy moly.
That movie is stunning. Yeah. I mean, it's like,
you can't turn it
Everything's
off.
Everything's in there. I know. Life, death, politics, all of
everything.
It. Business.
But then the real like earth shaking moment. Now I'd already been a lifelong cinephile and all this stuff. My brother saw this movie, Blue Velvet, David Fincher's movie. And he said, you know, he's got to see this. And maybe he described to me a little bit about what it was.
Yeah.
And I knew that there was some like weird psychosexual thing that I probably didn't have any grasp on because I was 15 years old.
I don't know that you would now.
Yeah, probably not. No. And that really like the sexual part of it wasn't really a component of it to me at the time. Not that I was conscious of. I sat down and I watched it. It was playing this theater in our neighborhood. And the first 5 minutes, that opening of that movie split my head open.
Yeah.
Because not only was I seeing like what a director did with sound and image and all this stuff, but it was this metaphor for the suburbs and what was crawling beneath the suburbs. And it never occurred to me to think about that.
Going
you
into
know?
The hole, right?
Yeah, it goes
right.
down into the lawn and there's all the bugs crawling around.
Is it right after the guy has a heart attack, right?
Yeah, you see like the crossing guard waving and the guy's on the fire truck and the white picket fence and the fire and then everything starts to go downhill.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You see the guy have a hose that he's watering his lawn, then he has a stroke, and then the dog is barking, and the dog is just licking the water off out of the hose,
and then
not
you go
helping
into
the guy.
Hole.
And then you go down into the lawn, and it's just tons of
bugs,
yeah. And so I immediately thought about where I came from and everything like that. That there was this like, you know, darkness crawling under this thing that I just sort of took for granted and thought was innocent. And then at that, really, like everything sort of came together in that moment that night I saw that movie, and I really think that altered the way I looked at the world and, you know, and movies. And,
there's no limit.
Know, my part in it. No, and like, you know, you can, you know, David Lynch has always struck me as someone that I'd like to be like, even if it's just as an actor who, if you can take what's in your head and in your heart and there's no filter, immediately transfer it on the thing and have someone else receive it and know where you're coming from. Like, I feel like Cronenberg and Lynch, like, do that really well, you know?
Yeah.
Then I could conceivably do that. You know what I mean? And that's a big influence on me and how I approach my work, even though I may approach my work very differently. I mean, David Lynch is someone who refutes psychoanalysis because he doesn't want to know. He feels like he won't be able to do it.
Right.
And I'm someone who goes 2 days a week. I'm someone who used to go 4 days a week, you know what I mean? And that's everything to me. Like, that's how I became, you know, a good writer. That's how I became, you know, good at this. I mean, it's certainly a big part of it, so.
Interesting. Yeah, but also, like, I like the idea of that, you know, when you watch that David Lynch movie for the first time, whether it's Eraserhead or Blue Velvet, and then you just realize, like, you set your own parameters.
Yeah, I guess that's, I didn't think about that part of it, but that's true too.
And it's just sort of like, you know, if people aren't, you know, you don't have to appease anybody.
No, look, I've been in this business for a long time, and there was a long period where I was trying to appease people or trying to be that handsome brooding actor that I saw that I wanted to be or whatever. And I just got rejected and I got knocked down. There's two whole years where I didn't work at all, you know? And I just kept going. I kept saying to myself, like, I can be a leading man in movies if I want to be.
Yeah.
And I am. You know, I don't have to be. I'm happy to take character parts and things. I love Sam Rockwell. I love Richard Jenkins. Those guys are great leading men and great character actors, you know? Like, but I just kept at it, and I never changed course. I mean, maybe there were years where I was like, oh, I'm not getting jobs. Maybe I should be more of this or more of that. And I got a little anorexic for a while, or I got a little weird for a while, you know. It ended in a complete nervous breakdown when I was in my late 20s, you know, and I sort of had to rebuild.
What, you end up in the hospital?
No, I could have. My dad, God bless him, came out here and took care of me for a while. But
how did that manifest itself?
I met a guy, a nice older man. I mean, I just was really wanting to be a movie star, and I was in my 20s, and I was, you know, I'm 5'10", and I weighed 145 pounds, and my hair was falling out, and I was just nuts, you know, and met this seemingly nice man who said, oh, you should start meditating, and I didn't know anything about it, and he said, here, send away for this tape, and I sent away for this tape, and it's a tape you listen to while you meditate, and it turns out it's from a cult. It was from one of these cult groups, and the tape had post-hypnotic suggestion on it that causes you to not go into deep sleep. Every time you're about to go into deep sleep, you wake up sort of with your heart beating really fast. And then it tells you to do the exercise again. So you just perpetuate this thing. And I think the sort of end game is this guy was like having, you know, meetings with me at my house and is eventually like, all I need is $2,000 to do this. Can you believe that? And it was kind of getting to that point. And the really strong ego in me that had been sort of like buried deep beneath eventually sort of woke up and
fought it.
And I just started therapy, so I was like dealing with a lot of stuff that I hadn't really like talked about or dealt with before. And so I would much rather find some spiritual, you know, reason than to have to actually go into like what my problems were and all that. And so this all sort of combined in this perfect shit storm, and I lost my mind, you know. I called my parents at, you know, 5 a.m. one night, and my dad got on a plane the next day and came out here and was with me for like a month. I mean, I went to Hawaii and filmed Pearl Harbor. I was in the middle of a complete mental collapse. I was also filming Ghost World at the time. This was a crazy time, and I just had to rebuild from there, you know. And I think at any time in my life since then, whether it's been the divorce or any other sort of major setback that I've had, I always know that my life will get better again if I just hang in there.
Well, when you have one real...
Yes.
Like, because I lost my mind once too.
Yeah.
So anything that happens, you know, matters at the heart or whatever, when you really experience losing your mind...
Yes.
That's the worst.
Yes.
And you can always have that as something to, as a barometer, you know, like...
Yeah.
You know, and you can be aware of it. I mean, because I don't know that a lot of people have experienced not... losing their mind.
No, like the closest I can tell people is like that movie Jacob's Ladder, where it's, you know, he's losing his mind and he's seeing these demons and stuff. I mean, that's really what it's like. You're seeing weird faces on the back.
Oh, you're hearing voices, like groups of voices.
It's crazy.
You're reading things into things.
Yeah, you read everything that you think every song that comes on the radio is a message to you.
Yeah, that's psychosis.
It's bad.
Yeah, I had that. Yeah.
So to be able to come back from that.
It's great.
I've been through some, that's great. And I've been through some, you know, I think two or three other sort of like earth shattering, you know, events in my life since then. But my life has gotten better than it was before things got bad every time after that. And it's continued to be so. So I don't know any differently. As bad as I'll allow myself to get depressed or anxious during hard times, but I can hang in there because I know it's going to get better again, you know.
That's good, man. Well, yeah. I think things are getting better.
Yeah, they are. And the work's getting better. Like, you know, not only am I, you know, job's getting better, but I'm better at what I do.
Yeah.
Even if I look at an interview with myself, I see like a relaxation that wasn't there before, you know. Yeah. Like, I don't see that, like, he's talking, but like in his eyes, he's going to murder you, you know, thing. Like, it's like
screaming inside.
And my friends will say, like, you know, you just seem, you know, so much more settled. And, or I'll see pictures of myself somewhere and not not have that thing like you were talking about, like, I don't know what to do with my hands or whatever.
I used to get it. Like, I have to consciously squint my eyes in photographs.
God. I studied it. I studied with this teacher who would always just be like, your eyes, right? Take attention out of your eyes. Like, you have to, like, you know, mentally and emotionally, like, take the tension out of your jaw and your eyes and your face, like, and just sort of, like, you know, sink it down in your core, whether it's your stomach or wherever, your pelvis, whatever.
So your face doesn't read like that.
You don't know you're doing it until someone points it out.
Like, you see a picture.
I was doing this thing in college when I first started, and I took a movement class, and I was sticking my neck out like this, I was walking around like that, like, and I was carrying, I mean, I probably still have neck and shoulder problems because I did that for so long, but like, I was just walking around looking like my head completely disconnected from my body, and my body just like not moving at all, you know, and my head just being this like ball of fire, you know, it's like Kirk Douglas's head on a tree trunk, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you got your head on.
Yes.
And thanks for talking to me, man.
Oh, it's been a blast. Thanks, Mark.
That was great. It was great to talk to Pat. It was great to see Pat. It was great to catch up with Pat. I think Pat's a real artist. And I think he's a great actor. I hope you enjoyed that. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get the app. Upgrade to that premium. And spend the rest of your life catching up with WTF. 520 some odd episodes out there, folks. Dig this, if you're still here. Bob Newhart on Monday. I talked to Bob Newhart, and I couldn't be more excited. My mouth feels funny. I think I ate too much pineapple. Boomer lives!